Hello and welcome to another Brewing Podcast, the geopolitical themed special today, as we welcome Marco Papich, the Chief Geopolitical Strategist at BCA. Many things to talk about at the moment, but our focus is on US and Chinese policy, and of course one eye on trade. And here is what Marco had to say in relation to the outcome of the midterms and what that means for Trump's trade agenda going forward.
So I don't think that he's going to take the message from the midterm election that he needs a deal at the upcoming G20.
Okay, for more detail behind that view, as well as some other important areas in geopolitics, not least Brexit, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're joined by a returning guest, a good friend to the podcast and a good friend to Brewin Dolphin, the geopolitical strategist at BCA, Marco Papich. Marco, thank you very much for your time, especially on the cusp of the G20. What time's your flight over to the meeting?
I'm getting a Learjet out there in a couple of minutes. No, okay. That's a joke. I'm not going there. Thank you for the invitation, Ben. It's always good to see you.
Okay, well, it's always a rich menu, the geopolitical sort of outlook, but I think most of our listeners may be fixated on Brexit, but I think we might try and avoid that or maybe save it to the end in this conversation. I want to focus more on the things that you would genuinely think will have more of an impact on global markets. And I would presume that has more to do with the evolution of US and China policy and how those two nations interact, of course. So if we could begin with the US, yeah. And I think in one of your earlier pieces in the year that you thought the midterms were a bit of a red herring, and I think that's sort of borne out, that it didn't really seem to move markets too much, maybe for a day, but it was soon forgotten. But what are your thoughts post-midterms as to what impact it could potentially have on how US policy unfolds?
So I think when I called it a red herring, it was probably a little too harsh, because the actual midterm election results do tell us something about the potential evolution of US policy. So first of all, I think the fact that the fiscal conservatives in the House are out is important. And what I mean by that is the Republicans got really crushed in the House. I mean, a 40-seat swing is no laughing matter. And what that means is that you have Democrats now in the House. Now, there are not many fiscal conservatives in the Senate. There never have been. So with the Republicans out of power in the House, it means the last fiscal kind of check on a populist president is gone. And Nancy Pelosi already signaled this by basically saying, look, we want an infrastructure deal. We know Trump does too. So that's something to keep in mind. Infrastructure deal could be potential. There might be a little bit of an impact on US fiscal thrust in 2020. The second is the trade war. And the fact that Republicans lost 10 out of 12 statewide races in the Midwest is going to signal to Trump that establishment Republicans like Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who lost his re-election, you know, anti-union, pro-free trade, they got crushed in this election. So I don't think that he's going to take the message from the midterm election that he needs a deal at the upcoming G20. And I think that's why any enthusiasm about the meeting, a potential, you know, we could have a deal to negotiate between US and China, that could be something that spurs the markets to rally over the next couple of days. I think that could be faded, because the political message from the midterms to me is that President Trump should double down on protectionism to ensure that he doesn't lose Midwest the way his establishment colleagues did.
So you're not discounting the probability or possibility of perhaps a ceasefire as a result of this G20, but over the medium term, the political message from the midterm is, you know, Trump, you know, stand firm, you know, go get a bigger deal, go get a better deal.
The way I see this is, I've been an alarmist in U.S.-China U.S.-China relations writ large for the last decade. That's been my view. It's a structural view based on structural factors, not on who's in power really, not on Trump or anything like that. I think if Hillary Clinton was the president, I'd have the same view. Now, that's a structural view. And as we know from economics, you can have a cyclicality to your structural view. So you're right. I do think there's a solid probability, I would say maybe as high as 40%, that there is a deal. I think the market thinks there's higher, I think 60%, 70%. I would have a lower view than that. I would have a lower odds of a deal at the G20. But I think that deal will either be a poor deal, it will fall apart, or it will merely be a deal to negotiate, and then those negotiations fail. And the fundamental reason for that is that there's just too much disagreement between the U.S. and China. It's not just about the trade deficit that the U.S. has. It's about high tech. It's about geopolitics. It's about all sorts of things.
Okay, well, let's think briefly about the impact that has on the U.S. consumer. You know, tariffs is a tax, you know, therefore, is that a real sort of retardation to growth?
So there's two reasons why I would, I hear that argument all the time, of course. That's the main reason that Trump would make a deal, that he would be afraid of his voters revolting. But I think that's, you know, I read that a lot in Wall Street research, and I think it's a hopeful view, and it's probably mathematically correct over the long term. But we have to understand that there's different time horizons. There's a time horizon over which the economic costs of a trade war will articulate themselves in household pocketbooks. And then there is the time frame over which policymakers act. And I think the two are different. So hoping for a deal tomorrow because of something that will hurt American pocketbooks over the next 24, 36 months, that's my problem with that view. Second, not clear to me that the American households will care about a 10% increase in the cost of toys, t-shirts, and toaster ovens. Why? Because we've got unemployment at below 4% and going lower. We've got more job openings than unemployed people in America. We've got wage growth picking up, and you've got middle-class tax cut. So if there was ever an opportunity for American policymakers to be tough on China and withstand the pain to the households from some price increases to things that are largely relevant to their household consumption anyways, this would be it. And the third issue is something that I think nobody's really talking about. Look, I don't think Trump's voting base is stupid. In other words, I think people understand that Walmart costs are going to go up. But they also have made this mental view, you know, they have a mental picture of $40 an hour manufacturing jobs coming back to their towns. Now, I disagree that that will ever happen. And I think you do, and I think all of Wall Street research disagrees that $40 an hour manufacturing jobs are going to come back to America for a number of reasons. Robotics, intermediate goods, you know, like American or manufacturing is not going to produce hexagonal screws. You know, that's not going to happen. But Trump's voters, including the Obama-Trump voters in the Midwest, very important, blue-collar voters who supported Trump and Obama, they believe that there is a possibility to get those jobs back. And so they're willingly going to go into a Walmart and pay 12% more for a toaster oven because they think that $40 good job is going to come back. Their nephew, who's an opioid addict, is going to get a good job, have middle-class lifestyle. And we can't dismiss that. You know, I think we dismiss this too much. We are using too clinical, too mathematical arguments and not thinking about politics. Voters are not rational actors. There isn't a rational choice view of voting because it makes no sense to vote. Mathematically, you're not going to impact the outcome. So why do voters vote? They do it through a logic of expressive choice. They vote to express their identity, their beliefs, and so on. And I believe that one of the beliefs that President Trump has tapped into is that, yes, we can have manufacturing back in the U.S. And that's a risk to investors because, you know, eventually those voters are going to feel betrayed by Trump when those jobs don't come back. But they may be giving him 2-3 years to accomplish the task. And that's very dangerous.
Okay, well, pretty cautious view on the trade policy evolution. If we look to domestic policy, I mean, you rightly point out that the U.S. economy is in excellent shape currently, but, you know, is this as good as it gets? We've got tax cuts that have been very generous to the U.S. economy. But is it not the case that they'll be fading on a year-over-year impact as we head into 2019? Is the fiscal agenda sort of tightening as we look into next year?
Yeah, so the fiscal thrust is going to be half as large as it was this year. So the fiscal thrust in the U.S. is definitely going to be lower. But if you look at the U.S. economy...
Is it going to evaporate entirely negative?
No, it's going to turn negative in 2020. Now, you know, when you go to the IMF, World Economic Outlook, the fiscal monitor, you know, the reason I have a job in finance, me in particular, is because that fiscal...
You know someone at BCA. Your father works at BCA.
The reason I have a job in finance is because the IMF's fiscal monitor is almost always wrong, right? Because you can't predict budget outlays. You need politics to be part of that discussion. And so what I would say is that, look, the fiscal thrust in 2020 is currently negative. That's what I call the stimulus cliff. And I think that will be reversed. So that's the first issue I would say. The second is that, yes, 2019, the effect will be lower, but it's still positive. The fiscal thrust, the cyclically adjusted primary deficit for 2019 is still positive. There will still be contribution to GDP growth from stimulus. It'll be half of what it was this year. But on the other hand, you know...
So in aggregate terms, that's saying the government is going to be even more generous in 2019 than in 2018?
No, less so. The fiscal thrust will be smaller than it was this year.
But is it not sort of the year-over-year change? Sorry, don't get sort of too...
No. So this year it was 1% of GDP. Next year is going to be 0.5% of GDP.
Right,
So yes, you're already looking at it from a derivative perspective, and it's going to be lower.
Okay.
But that said, the U.S. economy is still healthy. I mean, you have problems with CapEx. Some of the durable goods orders have been impacted negatively. Housing has been hurt as well by a 100 basis point rise in mortgage rates. But these are all things that, you know, the U.S. economy is currently digesting, the higher borrowing costs. And it can withstand them because consumers are going to start getting higher wages. And that's why with unemployment where it is, with wage growth picking up, I think you will see that 2019 will still be a year where the U.S. economy is stable. It will probably not do as well as it did this year, but we don't predict a recession. The yield curve is still about 100 basis points from being inverted. And if you look at leading economic indicators, none of these things are really indicating that recession is coming in 2019.
Okay, well, the final question on the U.S. before we switch to China. Sort of a conspiracy theory question, and I'm sure geopolitical strategists would quickly dismiss. But we've seen Jay Powell, the head of the Fed chair, turn a bit more dovish, very recently this week. And it wasn't long ago that, in fact, he said there was a lot of room a modest amount of room for
the
interest
neutral
rates.
The neutral rate is far, far away.
So they could raise interest rates quite a bit. And then this week he said, well, we can't raise interest rates that much. And in between that, you've had the Trump or the U.S. president say, you know, I don't like this appointment one bit. You know, his interest rate policy is off kilter. So do you think there is any relationship there? Or indeed, how would you rationalize this sort of U-turn from Jay Powell?
Well, first of all, we at BCA don't think there is a U-turn.
Okay.
We don't think. I mean, what he said was basically that the current interest rates are not far from the estimates. And it's true because the lower end of those estimates of the neutral rate are at like 2.5, 2.3. But the far end of that estimate is, 3.5%. So it doesn't mean that he said that we're not going to raise interest rates that much. We expect that inflationary pressures are going to build next year and that the Fed will respond to them. So I don't think there's really a conspiracy element here. He's just, I think, trying to calm the markets a little bit because his original comment was clearly taken very negatively by the markets. And he's trying to adjust to that. In other words, look, I'm not going to raise interest rates like 10 times. So I think there was a little bit of a correction relative to the original statement. In terms of the influence between...
So you do think he was influenced by financial conditions, markets?
Financial conditions have clearly gone down. In other words, they're asking for more for easing. But the other two parts of our Fed monitor, by the way, which is the economy and inflation pressures, are still asking for tightening. So in net terms, our BCA Fed monitor, which my colleague Ryan Swift, our U.S. bond strategist, looks at religiously, still calls for tightening, and we think that Powell will follow that. In terms of Fed independence and it being influenced by Trump, we don't think that that's an issue for this cycle. We think this cycle, the Fed will ignore President Trump. And one of the reasons for that, Well, there's three reasons. One, it's not the 60s. There's more transparency. Trump can't call Powell the way Nixon called Burns and said, baby boomers are going to destroy the country. I need inflation. You know, that's not going to happen. That was my Nixon impersonation.
It was bang on.
It was
my Frost impersonation.
So there's more transparency. It's difficult to influence the Fed privately, which would be more, it would be a lot more useful for Trump if he could do it privately. And when he does it publicly, he actually incentivizes the Fed to prove him wrong. And the second issue is that the Fed has staff and FOMC members that are clearly independent. It's not just Powell. There's other appointments there, too, who are not going to follow what Trump says. And that I think that's why this year we don't expect the Fed to really back off until things happen abroad, until the dollar goes up, and then the Fed backs off at some point in 2019. But it will not be because of endogenous U.S. factors. We think it's the exogenous factors that would influence the Fed more through the feedback loop of the dollar and yields and the financial conditions.
Okay, well, let's think about some of those exogenous factors then that could bring about a weaker dollar. That would be accelerating global growth. I don't know whether you would disagree with that.
But, yeah.
Clearly a catalyst for that would be, Chinese growth reaccelerating. And it would be good to get your take on how you're seeing the current stimulus programs. I think sometimes in markets it takes a little bit of time to understand what the Chinese data is telling us, and something like I say, after the event perhaps we realize how big or small it was. I mean, what is your current take on what's happening in stimulus, and is this a potential catalyst for re-acceleration of global growth?
Right, so China is objectively stimulating. I mean, like, they're clearly stimulating the economy. Reserve ratios have been cut. You've had greater tick up in bond purchases, in provincial bond issuance. And there's definitely been an acceleration in bank lending. However, from a perspective of total social financing, which includes the shadow financial system, which is 30% of all lending in China, total social financing is flat. So the way I would characterize, and the way my colleague Jonathan LaBerger, China investment strategist, the way that he characterized what's going on, is that Chinese policymakers are easing off the brake. They're not stepping on the accelerator. Tax cuts are part of that. I think the tax cuts are not sufficient to restart global growth because Chinese consumers are not necessarily going to buy imports with their tax cuts. They may not do anything with them. We don't know what fiscal multiplier of this tax cut would be. Also, they're likely to spend it on services inside of China. So what Chinese policymakers are doing is they're cautiously stimulating. It's not the irrigation style stimulus of the past. Total social financing is flat. And that's why we think it won't be enough to reaccelerate global growth next year. And when you combine that with our Fed view and our inflation view in the U.S., that means that there's more upside to the U.S. dollar throughout the course of 2019. And then at some point, I think that the emerging market weakness and global growth weakness will impact the Fed, and then the Fed will back off. So to go back to your question about the Fed, I think the Fed will back off, but not for endogenous U.S. reasons. It will be these exogenous risks that build throughout 2019. So it's a 12-month cyclical view. It's not a tactical view. I think on a tactical horizon, I think investors are definitely getting more bullish emerging markets and more bearish dollar. And you could see on a tactical basis, emerging markets outperform the U.S.
Okay, so we better quickly wrap up on two big issues at the moment before we just have a final say on your investment conclusions. The oil price is moving pretty fast to the downside. Do you see that is something that would can persist?
No, I don't, because the fiscal break-even for Saudi Arabia is $80, $85. So I don't think that they appreciate Trump's support enough to want to go bankrupt. I'm not saying they're going to go bankrupt, tomorrow. But I think $58 Brent is too low for Saudi Arabia. I don't think they can get $80, $85. But I do think that they will cut production. So we'll see over the next couple of days. They're meeting with Russia, I think, imminently at the G20. And so we should start getting information about what the size of that cut will be. But I do think that if we're right and if OPEC cuts, in addition to supply risks that we still have in the world, especially with Venezuela and production collapsing, oil prices should stabilize around $65, $70 for the rest of this year. And then potentially there could be more upside next year.
Okay, and then my final geopolitical question, of course, comes back to Brexit. It'd be very hard, very unfair of us. We pay for your service, so we will ask for this question. Brexit could obviously play out in many different ways, but what would be your what would be the sort of theories that you would ask us to hang our hat on? What would be the broad conclusions of where Brexit would end up? You know, could we get a no deal, for example?
No, I don't think there's going to be a no deal. I mean, I think the probability of that is less than 10%. I think, accidents do happen, but not when you can fix them right away. In other words, if there is a vote no in the House of Commons, you can have another vote. Or Theresa May can ask for an extension of Article 50, which of course the EU is going to give them, regardless of the parliamentary elections in Europe in 6 months' time. Or she can call a new election here and ask for another delay. There's all sorts of options that can happen that do not involve a hard kind of Brexit cliff or whatever you want to call it. So that's the one thing I have a high conviction view on. The second thing I have a high conviction view on is that in 2 years' time, we're going to be at the same exact position. Why? Because what's being voted on right now is the withdrawal agreement, which withdraws the UK from the EU. It doesn't resolve the future relationship. So we have no idea what the future relationship is going to look like between the UK and the EU. There's some outlines. There's this Norway Plus model being, you know, bandied about. But what I want to know is who in United Kingdom thinks that a Norway Plus arrangement is going to be good 2 years from now? Because see, right now it sounds great. But what the Europeans are not seeing is that, you know, that arrangement is going to cost a lot more than £30 billion a year. I mean, that arrangement is basically full access to the common market, full membership, if you will. And if you want full membership in an elite club, you're going to pay full membership fees. But then UK is going to say, but we don't want to decide what the wallpaper in the club is going to look like. We don't need that power. We don't need to vote on the acquis communautaire. And I just don't think that anyone in the United Kingdom 2 years from now is going to be cool with this Norway Plus option, because it basically means you have to pay the full membership fees, you have no say or very little say, you have the acquis communautaire of the European Union is produced. And I think that's a suboptimal outcome. So basically, there will be another referendum. I think that's a high conviction view, but it won't be a second referendum on Brexit. It will be basically the first referendum in the 21st century on joining the EU, right? So there is going to be that referendum at some point, because I just think the Norway Plus arrangement or some form of a soft Brexit doesn't make sense.
So trying to just finally draw out some investment conclusions then, the Fed stands pat, doesn't stand pat, you know, continues its hiking course. China's not going to unleash an aggressive stimulus. That is a dollar bullish view, an EM bearish view. What does that mean for global equities in 2019?
I think, we're coming to the end of the cycle and global equities are going to struggle to really outperform, I think, even cash. But U.S. outperformers...
That's where we end this conversation, Mark.
I think U.S. will outperform over the course of 12 months. Now, again, this is not a tactical view. I think tactically, you can build a very strong case for why global risk assets could do well. And I can paint you a very bullish picture right now. I mean, you've got dovishness being priced into the Fed by investors. You know, the Powell speech about where the neutral rate is, that seems dovish. People have forgotten about inflationary pressures in the U.S. Then you have some Chinese stimulus news flow that we don't know how to price as the investment community. And then on top of that, you could have, as I said, you could have a deal between Xi and Trump the next couple of hours. To negotiate. You know what? Let's put those January 1st tariffs on hold. So if you've got a little bit of a deal coming up on the trade, you've got Powell sounding dovish, stimulus, I think over the next quarter, maybe even 2 quarters, you could have risk assets globally outperform. But we don't think it's sustainable over the course of 2019. So if you're an investor with longer time horizon than tactical, and you don't have, if you're an investor who's not nimble enough to catch these tactical moves, for those investors, I think 2019 will ultimately look kind of like 2018, except that I do think that it's unsustainable to have an emerging market downturn that doesn't produce a Fed move in 2019. So in 2018, the Fed pretty much ignored what was going on globally. I think in 2019, it will be like the 1998-1994 scenario where the Fed backs off. And if that happens, if the Fed backs off in 2019, either stands firm or even cuts interest rates, you know, that will cause a mother of all rallies in risk assets. Let me just kind of conclude on this. I mean, 1998, the Fed cut interest rates after September, after the LTCM and Russia and all that stuff. 1999, most investors remember it as a Nasdaq.com bull kind of, hype. But actually, euro stocks and global risk assets outperformed the U.S. during 1999. And that's what's really interesting. I mean, if you want EM outperformance, I think it will come on the back end of Fed backing off because of EM trouble. And that could be what extends this cycle. If we're wrong and there's no extension to the cycle because the Fed doesn't back off and global growth is fine, then actually this cycle will end faster. And I think that's the paradox. Our view might sound bearish, but actually I think it prolongs the economic cycle because global growth concerns force the Fed to back off. And then you have a nice maybe 12 months, maybe 24, or hey, maybe 36 months of the extension of the economic cycle globally.
But the core view, developed markets look okay in the short term, but we're looking for a mid-year switch to emerging markets as the Fed blinks.
That's right. That's right. And so that's and that's why I would fade any bullishness right now on emerging markets and any bearishness in the dollar. I think it's not sufficient to really have a sustainable rally right now.
Okay, Marco, well, we must let you go. You've been very generous with your time, so thank you to you.
It's always a pleasure. Absolutely.
We'll certainly welcome you back in the new year to pick apart all those predictions. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. I'll leave a review on SoundCloud or iTunes, whatever platform you listen to us to. But until next time, many thanks for listening. And Marco, go get that jet to Buenos Aires.
Yes.